And live from Future in Review Conference at Stein Erickson Lodge in Park City, Utah, this is Cool Science Radio. I'm John Wells, and I'm here with my co-host, Lynn Ware Peake.
Good morning, John. Well, the Future in Review Conference exposes world experts and participants to new ideas in a manner that produces an accurate portrait of the future in technology, including the global economy, cloud computing, biology, medical diagnostics, policy, netbooks, space travel, sustainability, and other fields that contribute to technology outcomes. Economist Magazine calls Future in Review the best technology conference in the world.
Lynn, I'm so excited that we're here this morning. There's such a buzz in this place, and all of the feedback that we're getting on all the different conferences has been just so powerful. You know, it's just really quite the conference.
It is, and I can't wait to get to our first guest.
Yeah, and I understand that they have already committed to being back here at the Stein Erickson Lodge next year.
So that's right.
It's all great. Our first guest this morning is Khan Shlobashnikov, who is the author of Chasing Dr. Doolittle, Learning the Language of Animals. Khan is the CEO of Animal Communications LTD and the director of the Animal Language Institute. The name of the panel that Khan will be heading at the Future in Review Conference is The Patterns of Language Using Computers to Communicate with Other Species.
Khan, welcome to Cool Science Radio.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
So you studied lots of animals out in the field, but this all relates back to technology because you, sort of like maybe a Rosetta Stone or something like that, were able to interpret via a computer model the language of animals.
Right. I've been working for many years studying the language of prairie dogs, and that was only possible because of technology. And so what I've been looking at is prairie dogs give an alarm call in respect to a predator, and we can record that alarm call. We can also videotape the responses of the prairie dogs when they see the predator, when they hear the alarm call. We can play back the alarm call when no predator is there, and if the prairie dogs do exactly the same thing to the playback when no predator is there, we know that there's meaningful information. So with the audio stuff that we get, we take it back to the lab, we put it on a computer, the computer breaks the audio signal into a picture that tells us what the frequency and time elements are. So it's just like a series of wavy lines on a screen. We can then measure all of these different frequency changes, put this into a computer, into a statistical routine, and the statistics tells us what is in the call, whether the call is, say, for a coyote, or whether the call is for a human, or whether the call is for a domestic dog, or for a red-tailed hawk. And then after that, we can do experiments where we have, say, different humans walking out in different colored shirts, of different size humans, different shape humans, and we can record the alarm calls of the prairie dogs to those, and we find using these techniques that the prairie dogs not only have words for different predators, like coyote and dog and human, they also have adjectives for the size and shape and color of the predators, and verbs like for the speed of travel of the predators. So what we've done is we've essentially decoded the most sophisticated animal language that is known so far. Now I say so far because I'm anticipating that once we start using these same techniques, we'll find that whales and dolphins and chimps and so on will also have very sophisticated languages. But so far, using this technology, it is prairie dogs that rule the day.
I had an opportunity to take a look at a YouTube video that you did on exactly what you're talking about, on the prairie dog, when a coyote would present itself, a dog, or a human. And these sounds were very distinct once you started listening to them. And then these different adjectives, as you describe, that are talking about size and color. And then on top of that, prairie dogs have different dialects depending upon where they are in the country, like a southern gentleman versus someone from New York.
Right. Yeah, absolutely. It is so fascinating. Even colonies that are separated by a couple of miles have mild dialects. And then once you start going long distances, like going from Arizona to New Mexico or from New Mexico to Colorado, they start having more pronounced dialects. So it's very much just like human speech.
It's so interesting to me that, you know, we already know so much, as you say, about the language of dolphins or whales, that you chose the prairie dog. And I assume it's because, as a professor at Northern Arizona University, is this the animal that was most readily available to study? Or did you just have some particular fascination for the prairie dog?
Well, actually, it was kind of serendipity because, as you say, it was the animal that was readily available because at that time, around Northern Arizona University, there were a number of colonies. Now, unfortunately, some years later, we are down to only one colony because prairie dogs in general have been rapidly declining and we're now down to about 1% of the numbers we had 100 years ago. But when I started working, there were a lot of colonies of prairie dogs. And so it was easy for me to get my experiments set up, get my students out there. Other biologists might have to travel 2,000 miles to Africa, and I had to travel 2 miles to my field site. And the other advantage is that because the prairie dogs are colonial and they live in colonies which stay there year after year, I could come back to record exactly the same individuals day after day after day or from 1 year to the next. And so that gave me a boost up, which people who work with dolphins or whales don't have because the dolphins and whales go away and you never know who you're recording.
Lynn, I wouldn't be surprised if crows and magpies, if the same sort of phenomena might happen. We've had some crow experts on Cool Science Radio. And it was just fascinating to learn how they premeditate murder like humans do, the only other species that does that. And they never forget a face. If it's a cat or if it's a human, very, very smart species. I hope that maybe you'll have an opportunity to study them one day.
Well, I hope so too. But actually, in my book, Chasing Dr. Doolittle, I discuss different animal languages. And with crows and ravens, they actually have a large number of calls, and they can actually put the calls together kind of like we assemble sentences. So they can actually communicate a tremendous amount of information. Part of the problem, though, is that we still need to decode actually what those calls are.
So interesting. So a raven or a crow might have an adverb, an adjective, a noun, a verb in a sentence.
Right.
Wow. Prairie dogs, they're kind of simple. They kind of do this chi-chi-chi-chi, right? And tell us the story. You have this great story about how prairie dogs also, as John said, is it crows that premeditate murder? You have prairie dogs that lie to each other. Talk about that.
Right. Well, here's one anecdote that I can tell you. Some of my students were observing a fight between two male prairie dogs over territory. So one of the males was really beating the stuffing out of the other male, and the other male was really clearly losing. And that loser male suddenly gave an alarm call for a coyote. And the other one looked up and must have thought, oh my God, there's a coyote out there. I have to run to my burrow. So he quickly ran to his burrow, leaving the other guy to stroll back to his burrow, sort of untouched.
You know, they say never trust a prairie dog.
That's right. So I have a question about how you got into and how you decided that computer modeling and some sort of program that could be developed would help you in your endeavor. I mean, we're at a technology conference. And so talk about the computer model and the software that was developed specifically to help you in your quest for figuring it all out.
Well, actually, the computer models that I was initially using were developed by the U.S. Navy to track submarines, because initially what I was working with was a box that gave these frequency and time elements that you could see in real time. So as you played the tape, all of these pictures would scroll across the screen. But The box inside was classified, so I couldn't really open the box, but the Navy figured out that they could use this kind of technology to track the acoustic signatures of enemy submarines.
Yes.
And so I was able to adapt that.
I remember in Clancy's book, The Hunt for Red October, and then of course the movie that came out afterwards, how they were able to, I think they were talking about Ivan was the name that they gave to the boomers, the submarines that had missiles from the Soviet Navy, how they were able to ascertain what type of vessel was coming towards them by the acoustic signature. So there's actually something to this. It must be top secret.
Well, yeah, probably right now, actually, it isn't top secret. And I think that now this kind of technology has gotten to the point where actually you can use these programs, you can buy these programs for like $60 and put it on your computer, and everybody can do what before I used to be able to do with spending thousands of dollars and getting this classified equipment.
Our Navy should take a page from the coyotes, I mean from the prairie dogs, and say, you know, a coyote's coming, throw out a different signature and have some fun with it. The Russians won't know what's going on.
That's right.
Actually, it's the red Chinese we need to think about.
Yeah. So I'm wondering, here's my smartphone, this smartphone that I will hit voice text and I'll speak into, and it will translate my language. Will there be a day soon, say the next 5 years, that I can purchase for someone in my family to put in their, say, Christmas stocking, a little device that they can hold up to my dog's mouth as the dog is whining, groaning, barking, and it will translate what that dog is saying?
I think it's getting there fairly quickly because, for example, we did something like that with prairie dogs. We used artificial intelligence programs so that the computer would listen to a prairie dog call, and then the artificial intelligence program would translate that for us and spit back to us potentially in English, coyote. And we could potentially go back the same way. We could say something like dog, and the computer would synthesize the sound. So I think that we are right on the cusp of getting there because we have now the technology, we have the artificial intelligence programs to be able to do that. What we now need, like for example, for your dog, what we now need is to come up with a dictionary of different barks in different contexts so that the device will then be able to say when your dog goes bark, bark, the device will be able to say, I want to have chicken tonight.
Yeah.
Or how about, I just ate that chicken off of the table.
Yeah, thanks a lot.
No, the dog would never say that.
That's right, they're too smart.
The dog would say the cat did it.
Right.
This has been an extraordinary conference for a lot of people that I've gotten feedback from. Tell us about your experience here at the conference, and as a result of meeting people in different disciplines within technology, will it help you to collaborate with them to push your work forward?
Definitely. This is a fabulous conference. It's got a lot of very smart people here, and people are essentially talking about cutting-edge stuff that really isn't available out there for most people to know about. And so when I listen to this cutting-edge stuff, I get ideas about how I can apply this cutting-edge stuff to my stuff. Maybe these people are talking about cutting-edge stuff in say, cell phones or something like that. But then I get an idea, wow, I can use this kind of stuff to work on just the kind of thing that you were talking about, you know, a device that would let us communicate with dogs, say, or communicate with a variety of other animals. And so I think that by using this cutting-edge stuff, I think we're probably about 5 years out from being able to communicate with our dogs, communicate with our cats, and possibly then later communicate with a large number of animals, like crows, like lions, like dolphins, like chimps, and so on. And I think that once we get there, my hope is that this will allow us to develop a partnership with animals so that we will have more respect for animals, so that we will appreciate animals for the thinking beings that they are instead of the way that we currently exploit animals.
Right. Fantastic work. And I just want to say one more thing, and that is that, you know, of all the topics at the Future in Review conference here at Stein Erickson Lodge, this one has to be quite unique. I mean, we have lots of talk about patterns, visualization, artificial intelligence, but Dr. Doolittle, you must be quite unique here.
Well, yes and no, actually, because when you think about it, language is a series of patterns. And so the kind of stuff that the conference is exploring here, applying it to other patterns like data patterns and so on, this is very similar to the kind of stuff that I'm doing, except in a slightly different context. So in reality, it does fit into the general theme.
Con, we want to thank you so much for joining us this morning, and hopefully next time you're in Park City, we can get together again.
Thank you very much for having me.
Con Shlobodnikov is the author of Chasing Dr. Doolittle, Learning the Language of Animals. He is the CEO of the Animal Communications LTD and the director of the Animal Language Institute. Just a fascinating conversation. Thank you, Con. Yeah. And when we return, we will be speaking with Brett Horvath, the co-founder of Scout, which combines investigative reporting with near-term science fiction. This, of course, is Cool Science Radio, and I'll just take a moment and tell you who our third guest is this morning as well. We'll be speaking, after we speak with Brett, with Evan Anderson, who's the Director of Marketing of the Strategic News Service and Director of Research and author of Theft Nation, How IP Theft Drives the Chinese National Business Model and Its Effect Upon the Global Economy. The name of the panel that Evan is heading up is the Future in Review Conference is Behind the China Crash, How China Makes Money. He's the director of a consortium of U.S. companies and experts who have put together a report, and this is scary, claiming that 50% of Chinese growth in recent decades has been founded on the stealing of Western business ideas. So we'll be speaking with Brett Horvath, very much looking to that, forward to that conversation when we return, and then Evan Anderson. You're listening to Cool Science Radio, only in Park City, only at KPCW.
Voters are being asked to approve a $56 million Park City school bond. The Project for a Deeper Understanding presents a forum Tuesday, October 13th. The Park City school bond. Is it the right program at the right time? At 7 p.m. at St. Luke's Church. KPCW will broadcast the forum live. The Project for a Deeper Understanding on KPCW is made possible by a donation from Tesh Law, real estate, construction, and HOA law since 1989. TeshLaw.com.
Hi, this is David Jensen, the director of the Habitat for Humanity ReStore in Park City. If you've been to the ReStore, you already know about the incredible treasures and deals found there every day. Do you have gently used furniture, appliances, cabinets, or building materials that could use a new home? Donate them to the Habitat ReStore and help families in our area. You can bring your items to us or call us for our pickup service. As always, the ReStore is open to the public and proud to be a local nonprofit KPCW supporter.
And welcome back to Cool Science Radio. I'm Lynn Ware Peak here with my co-host, John Wells. We're coming to you live from the Future in Review Conference here at Stein Erickson Lodge in Park City. We were just speaking with Con Shlobodnikov. He's the author of Chasing Dr. Doolittle, Learning the Language of Animals. Our next guest joining us here in our makeshift studio is Brett Horvath. He's the co-founder of Scout, which combines investigative reporting with near-term science fiction. Scout covers the intersection of technology, economics, and morality. Brett is a technologist, a writer, and a community organizer. He has a background in big data, machine learning, risk modeling, and technology policy. Brett has been speaking at the Future in Review Conference about the moral implications of artificial intelligence. Brett Horvath, welcome to Cool Science Radio. It's a pleasure to have you.
Thank you so much for having me. This is exciting.
So, you know, it's so interesting when you use the word artificial intelligence, or the phrase, along with the moral implications. You know, it used to be that computers were black and white, It was objective. And now we're getting into a much more murky world. Talk about some of the biggest things that come up for you in terms of what makes it murky.
Yeah, well, I'll just start by saying most often when you hear conversations around ethics and technology, it's kind of seen as anti-technology, that you're raising the concerns and the fears, but that really isn't the case with me. I'm definitely an optimist. Generally, I lean optimistic, but I think that asking the questions of what are the moral implications is actually an incredibly powerful tool to understand where things are going, both for good or bad. So that's kind of my starting point. As far as the implications of where artificial intelligence is going, Khan, the last guest, was actually a fantastic example. Artificial intelligence, machine learning, and pattern matching are now opening up this age where we can communicate with animals. And that's fascinating. There was a session yesterday where someone at Microsoft is doing a program using Kinect, the Kinect console, to interpret the body language of dogs and allow humans to communicate with dogs. Now, that's a really great question. If AI is helping us communicate with animals, whether it's dogs, cats, cows, how is that going to change the way humans relate to other species? You know, it's one thing when we hear these beautiful noises or have whale song mixtapes to go to sleep to, but it's another when we can hear complex emotive thoughts and expressions. And I think that's a really interesting place that's coming up. The other is it's getting easier and easier to code machine learning and AI algorithms. And each one of those AI algorithms has bias. I mean, just by the nature of being built in. Yeah.
Of course.
The code is the law, and that's the result you get. And so whether that's a recommendation engine from Netflix saying, well, you like this certain kind of movie, or I've tagged you as a certain demographic, you must like this other set of movies. That is a really important effect on reinforcing our own perception of mm-hmm. reality and then building our own identity. And that's an interesting question, is who gets to decide that? And where's our own efficacy in deciding where that goes? I'll just start it there and we can take it to other places.
Yeah, that is so fascinating, especially when Netflix ends up telling you what you like more than you knew what you like. And I think that's where it starts to be a little unsettling. And it does start to get into morality, because then it can really shape the perception of the human. So the computer manipulating the human, essentially. I mean, mm-hmm. is that fair to say?
Well, I think it's a fair question to ask. And this is where it gets really interesting, is humans, we really need help in behavior modification. You know, whatever our goal is, it's hard to do it on our own. And these type of nudges, as behavioral economists call them, can be really positive to help us lose weight or do better habits. But, you know, there was a really controversial Facebook study that was released, basically saying they ran a study changing the results of what came up in people's news feeds having to do with people's moods. And if they realized that they showed a few more negative words, connotation or positive connotation words, they could actually affect people's outcomes, the posts they would express. And they did it at such a minute level, they didn't want to like really mess with anyone, but it caused such a backlash. Because it's like, wow, here's this undetectable phenomenon you could put in the system that over a billion people are on. What effect would that have if you wanted to change the outcome of an election or change people's perception around a candidate or a celebrity?
Are endless.
Yeah, really. And I have a friend that I have several friends that work at Facebook, and I kind of ran through the scenario. And it's like, what would it take to do something like that? And it's like, well, at Facebook, they have this kind of move fast and break things culture. They have a hacker culture. And they're like, basically, it takes one programmer to write the code, and then another to approve it, and then it ships. And Facebook is just one example of many companies that are in this very empowered age where we can just ship things to a lot of people very fast. But there's really, we have no sense of social norms or governance of how to say, is that a good thing? Is that a bad thing? Who's watching this?
I think the morality of artificial intelligence is something that absolutely needs to be studied. But I also think it's interesting that they can have unintended biases that are put in based on the algorithms. And people get really excited about oh boy, should we let computers allow prisoners' parole paperwork to be reviewed by a computer or not, with these little unintended biases. And yet, we had this guy on several weeks ago, and we were talking about prisoners and parole applications. And they had these judges that were sitting in this room, humans, human being judges, who were looking at the parole applications. And they did this intensive study, and they found that about 40 to 45% of the parole applications were accepted at like 9-ish in the morning. And then right before lunch, it went up to 85% were denied because they were grumpy and they were hungry. And they got back from lunch at 2 o'clock and they were real happy and they were full. And then they switched to 85% that they approved. And then they had sort of like a mid-afternoon slump and everyone started getting trashed again. So it depended upon where you were in the stack of parole applications. So when they talk about computer biases, boy, we have a lot of human biases, don't we?
I think that's a great point, and that's an example where, yeah, maybe we should have a more algorithmic approach to it. I mean, it's terrible to think about how many people get prosecuted, don't get parole because someone's hangry, you know? And whether it's the coders or whether it's the people who are just trying to make a decision, I would say most of the time it doesn't have to do with the nefarious intent. It's really just where people are operating from.
They're hungry.
And, yeah, I mean, at the end of the day, we're not that evolved of a species. We're we have needs, we have hunger, and that goes into our complex decision making. And I think another place where that comes in is driving. I think it is kind of a bug that we found out how to build cars and drive before we made computers that could drive them for us.
Right.
I mean,
exactly.
I personally love driving, but I don't think people should be the default drivers. I mean, you get texting, you get tired. And that's a place that I'm actually really excited to see the self-driving car revolution hit full force. And Elon Musk was just asked a couple days ago at an interview at Vanity Fair, their big conference. He said, "When do you think self-driving cars will hit the road in a big way?" And he said, 2 to 3 years max.
Exactly.
Yeah. And I've talked to CTOs of a couple different cities, and I said, "What's your policy on self-driving cars?" And they're like, "Oh, it's all science fiction." I was like, you realize that you probably have some self-driving cars on your road right now. Mm-hmm. You know, Tesla, through the P85D, did an over-the-air software update, making some of their cars self-driving. Mm-hmm. And it's a really interesting phenomenon because Tesla has been very careful. They call it autopilot mode. They basically don't want to get a PR or a regulatory backlash. But Elon Musk has said, these cars that you can buy now will take you from Seattle to San Francisco, and you don't have to touch the steering wheel.
Yeah.
And that's a huge question for us. I think it's great because it'll save lives. There are over 30,000 people that die because of car crashes every year. But at the same time, you look at jobs, the biggest, quote, unskilled job category in America is drivers. It's 2 million people.
Right.
And,
especially 16-year-old drivers.
Yeah. Yes, yeah, that I think we can all agree that's probably a good thing.
So technology is this freight train that you're not going to stop. It just rolls. I mean, just rolls down the track, and it's not going to be slowed down. However, when I think about autonomous driving, there are so many positive aspects to what that will bring to us. But I'm worried about the short-term challenges of what it's going to do to our economy, because if people start signing up in sort of a subscription service for an automobile and this shared type thing happens, then the automobile agency and all of the parts companies that are supplying, and the tire companies and the insurance companies, because insurance will go down, there are so many aspects economically that will be affected in a very short period of time, because when it rolls out, it will roll out like a freight train. So that's what I worry about.
Yeah, and two points on that. I think that's totally right. And for us at Scout, that's why we focus on the intersection of technology, economics, and morality. I think, 4 years ago, I was telling people self-driving cars is going to come a lot faster than you think. And the reason was, it's not just about the technology. It's not just in R&D labs. There are really strong economic drivers, excuse the awkward pun, but that keep people motivate them to adopt self-driving cars, like insurance companies, like cities that can't build roads fast enough to accommodate their population. And so there's this massive rush to get them to make it adopted. And that's really hard to stop. I'll come back to the economic implications in a second. But you said, you know, technology is a freight train. It's coming fast. There's nothing you can do to stop it. I will both agree and disagree with that. I think that it's really important that we all educate ourselves about technology. It's no longer a realm for, quote, techies or nerds. Technology now means civics. They're inseparable. And if you want to be a citizen, you really need to understand the technology implications of what the government is doing, what private companies are doing. But I really reject the notion that's kind of popularized in the Silicon Valley culture that says, you know, tech is inevitable. We're on this curve. Because I think that removes a sense of efficacy and power that we're still a population that governs ourselves. We can decide if a technology goes too far or do we need to make a certain change to it. And we've done that throughout, you know, the last 150, 200 years. So I really, I think, yes, you know, you've got to get on the train. You've got to understand what's going on. But we also, as a population, can decide, you know, what we want and don't want, what we think is right and what we think isn't right. So I think it's important to keep both those, that tension in our mind.
So the challenge is the three of us as individuals may have a point of view on how fast autonomous cars are rolled out, but how do we compete with Uber and Google and Apple, who have a very strong desire to make this happen? And of course, they have the dough and the lobbying power. So how much of our voice is actually heard?
I think that's a great question. And I think that that's an experiment that hasn't fully played out yet. I think one of the early places to look is Uber. So Uber at the beginning said that they wanted to organize themselves more as a political campaign than a company. They knew that if they were going to go in and, you know, break up and get past regulatory hurdles or get past taxi cartels, they were going to have to lobby and build street teams and pressure city council candidates. And I think that's done some good. I think they've also, you know, it's come out, they've deployed some pretty dirty tricks. And this is one of the first times we've seen a tech company, kind of tech first, have a full-throated lobbying campaign on multiple fronts. You don't see that same kind of effort from Google or Apple. They definitely have lobbyists. They definitely have footprints in D.C. and Berlin and Brussels. But it's going to get really interesting and challenging when you see things like self-driving cars come out. I mean, you're going to see more lobbying groups, more pressure on elected officials. Now, one of the places I think this is interesting, you brought up the economic implications of technology, which I think is interesting. I think the automation revolution is happening much faster than people realize, whether it's self-driving cars.
Agreed.
Or, you know, software as a service that's getting rid of white-collar jobs. And one of the outcomes of that is, you know, we just went through what many people call a jobless recovery. And you get more jobs, they get eliminated because of the automation revolution. Well, what do you do? Well, in kind of elite Silicon Valley circles, they're starting to be funding for groups and support of this idea called universal basic income. And it's the idea that everyone, no matter what, gets a baseline income. And it's, you know, anywhere between $40,000 and $60,000. It's rather than having, you know, government programs to take care of this need or that need, just give everyone a baseline salary.
And Star Trek.
Yeah, totally. Yeah, and it's the, you know, today you would say that's impossible in our political climate.
Yeah.
You know, that could never take place. But 4, 5, 6 years from now, or if there's another macroeconomic correction, and there aren't the same jobs that there used to be, and it's not just, you know, people that are unskilled or whatever, but middle class educated people that can't get jobs, I think that's going to become that could become a major issue in American politics in not too far from now, and there's a lot of support for that idea, you know, in leadership at Google and Apple and Microsoft, because they don't want the pitchforks coming for them. Right. You know, when their systems and technologies start getting rid of jobs and whole classes of jobs, you know, they don't want the anger directed at them. And I think it's kind of the scary and the exciting part is on the scary side. What are we going to do with all these jobs? On the positive side, if we figure it out as a society, we can liberate ourselves from a lot of work that people don't really want to do. And we can start asking ourselves, what else can we do as individuals and as a society if we freed up more of our labor and our time? So it's both exciting and terrifying, but worth talking about.
fascinating topic. Brett, before we let you go, you're the co-founder of Scout, and we know kind of what you do, but how does one find the work that you do there at Scout?
Yes, so we just launched. We did a Kickstarter campaign in July, which went really well. Reached our goal of 30,000 in 7 days. Got a bunch of cool people involved. If you're interested in learning more, go to joinscout.com. And you can see kind of our video and the Kickstarter we did. And we're going to be launching later this fall, which will be really exciting. We're going to tackle a really big topic. I won't go in too much detail right now, but it will have to do with artificial intelligence. Mm. So if you're interested in these topics and looking at where it might go in the future, we'll be doing coverage, but then we'll also have science fiction short stories by New York Times bestselling science fiction authors exploring, you know, what could this be in 4, 5, 6 years from now?
Yeah. My career, just a real quick question. My career was technology for 25 years, and the different disciplines in technology used to be standalone islands of competence, and now collaboration is the new thing. As you've attended this conference this week, tell us quickly about how you believe you're able to learn more and collaborate with these other disciplines that are presented here at the convention.
Absolutely. Well, I think that one of the things I love about the Future in Review conference is it's not just about the big names. There are certainly big names, but there are people that are building the tech, you know, the CTOs, the programmers, but there's also documentary filmmakers and scientists and people. That's really kind of a technology conference with a soul is one of the ways I describe it. You know, people doing their work at the highest levels that really understand the work they do either has a big impact on the world or can have a big impact. So like Khan, for example, he met an enterprise software engineer at Microsoft at Future in Review 2 years ago. And then they said, hey, can we do something together?
Yeah.
And then now they demoed the Kinect dog translator that they're working on, which is so cool. And for us, I'm always looking for what can I learn from other disciplines? What can I learn from what documentary filmmakers have to say or scientists whose fields I didn't even know existed until 5 minutes ago? And I think that culture of collaboration and that sense that, you know, we do have an obligation to make sure our work does good in the world is really a powerful force to learn and innovate.
Well, Brett Horvath, it's been a pleasure having you. It's really fascinating stuff. You must love what you're doing. And best of luck with Scout. We'll look forward to it and maybe having you back on once you reveal the big topic.
I would love to. Thanks for having me.
That's Brett Horvath. And when we return, we'll be back with Evan Anderson. He's the Director of Marketing, Strategic News Service. We'll be talking about how intellectual property theft drives the Chinese national business model. Another fascinating topic here at Future in Review. We'll take a short break here for some underwriters, and then we'll be right back. This is Cool Science Radio, only in Park City, only on KPCW.
Support for KPCW comes from the Natural History Museum of Utah, a nonprofit organization hosting an Indian art market this weekend, October 10th and 11th. This juried show offers handmade jewelry, beadwork, sculpture, painting, and more from Native American artists. The museum is located just minutes from Park City in the Foothill Cultural District. Information about Indian art market and all museum exhibits, events, and membership are online at nhmu.utah.edu.
This is Michelle from Peak Art and Frame, proud supporters of KPCW. Locally owned and operated, Peak Art and Frame features local photography and artwork, as well as digital printing, custom framing, and mirrors. Open 7 days a week, rush service available, located in the Walmart Shopping Center, 649-0801, peakartandframe.com.
That's right, be careful. And welcome back to Cool Science Radio. We are live from Stein Erickson Lodge. This is the Future in Review Conference. And I'm taking a note here from Roger. Everything cool? Okay, good. We're good. This is the Future in Review Conference, and we are here right now with our final guest, Evan Anderson, who's the Director of Marketing of Strategic News Service and Director of Research for INVNT/IP. I hope I got that acronym correct.
We call it Invent IP, but
Invent IP, and author of Theft Nation: How IP Theft Drives the Chinese National Business Model and Its Effect Upon the Global Economy. The name of the panel, Evan's heading, is the Future in Review Conference: Behind the China Crash, How China Makes Money. Evan is the Director of Research for INVIS, a consortium of U.S. companies and experts who have put together a report claiming that some 50% of Chinese growth in recent decades has been founded on the stealing of Western business ideas via the old-fashioned industrial espionage and more sophisticated state-sponsored hacking. Evan, welcome to Cool Science Radio.
Thank you. It's a pleasure to be here.
Yeah. How's the conference going for you?
So far, it's going amazingly. So FIRE is always a highlight of the year for, I think, probably everyone that comes here, at least myself, and I think I speak for a lot of others. We have a kind of a giant conglomeration of some of the best minds in technology and science, and everyone comes together and really produces an amazing amount of content for how short of a time period we have to be together. So it's always a complete ride.
Yeah, and this subject that you are that you've spoken with at the panel is something that a lot of people think about. But 50% of the Chinese economy that is possibly driven by industrial espionage, that's a pretty scary number.
Yeah, it is scary. It's probably one of the defining issues of our time. And when I say probably, I mean absolutely. I think one of the most important things that came out during our research was that you can't trust any of the numbers coming out of China. And any expert who really focuses on this subject will tell you that. They're all adulterated. So when you start digging, you're trying to find what is real. And it's always a bit of a shell game because the government conceals so many things. So you start to look at their GDP numbers and they're not right, and you know that, but they've all got gaps, and they've got gaps between it could be, anywhere from this number to this number, and it can be a 20% spread, which is unheard of in other countries in the world. So what we did was look at all their GDP numbers and look at factors such as power consumption and industrial output, where you're trying to figure out what's a good metric in a place where you can't trust the numbers, and you start to see a whole lot of fake value, essentially. So without delving too much into it, we're pre-release on a lot of the research, so I can't go too far into it, but there's a lot of fake value, and it becomes really quite clear, and the only thing that isn't clear is the exact numbers. So our estimate is that it could be up to 50%, which is appalling and has really bad implications for the global economy.
Right. It's interesting, Evan. This kind of intellectual property theft is it's not new to us at all. In the very most basic ways, decades ago, you could buy a Gucci handbag that had been, reverse engineered or reverse designed, however they call it, anywhere you go, really. And so getting back to this question, it was interesting because we were just speaking with Brett Horvath about morality. And what is it intrinsically about the morality or lack thereof, or is it just the ability to hack into other people's technologies by the Chinese? I mean, I realize that's a kind of a general question, a broad question, but what's your thought on that? What's your take? If you can, why not do it? I mean,
right. I think that you can talk about the cultural values, and they're often cited. Copying is, I think, considered less of a problem in China. But at the end of the day, you're still talking about IP theft that goes directly against agreements that they've signed. And rather than harp on and on about the ethics of it, which, it's clearly unethical, more than that, it hurts the global economy and it destroys the incentive to innovate, which in the long run is bad for everyone, including the Chinese. I think what's more important when you really focus on the results of the problem is it's less of an ethical issue than the people that are really putting this together over there are probably in a position where they're between a rock and a hard place. Mm-hmm. And right now, this is the most convenient solution for them. They want a high GDP. If you're the Standing Committee of China, you want a high GDP. You want to, make this look really good to your populace. And you need to. You need to do that in order to maintain power. So you can go on and on about whether it's unethical, but for them, they need to do it to stay where they are. And so we need to provide an economic solution to this problem that isn't, it's far from the realm of diplomacy, because diplomacy won't get us anywhere. They currently are incentivized to do this, and we need to disincentivize them.
Hmm. So what does that look like? I mean, where are we? I think one of the things you're talking about here at Future in Review is security and new sort of hurdles that we've overcome in security. Mm-hmm. Where are we?
The security side of it gets very complicated, but I think we're making great advances in the way that we look at that. I think that we are getting better as a nation at understanding just how much intellectual property we have, and we have better and better teams that protect that. In terms of where this is going broadly, I think we're doing really well. We have large glimmers of hope that we haven't seen before right now. On April 1st, and it was not an April Fool's joke, the president issued an executive order that provided kind of the first ammunition for the Justice Department and the Treasury Department here to go after people that are stealing U.S. intellectual property. And as opposed to kind of the platitudes that we heard in politics before, this executive order said, if you're doing this or if you're associated with it, we will go to wherever you are, we will block your bank accounts, and we will stop you. And there will be real economic disincentives, which is something that we didn't see before right about then. So that was really encouraging. And we saw a lot of indictments come out of the US DOJ. That was a good start, and it needs to continue. But yeah, I think that we're making a lot of progress right now that we haven't seen for years. We've been through this over and over and over again, and we really weren't doing much about it until probably this last year. And so that timeline is really accelerated, and that's really exciting if you're worried about this issue.
Well, back to the Chinese, do you think they would recognize this? Do you think they would, I mean, they basically have an attitude, it's sort of an in-your-face attitude, and well, you know, I'll tell you a story I heard a couple of years ago. There was a next-generation fighter jet that we were developing. We were in good shape on the Pentagon side of keeping it nice and clean, but our contractors on the outside did not set up the correct firewalls, and the Chinese hacked in there and stole hundreds of thousands of pages of what this next generation and the advanced avionics and everything.
That was the Raptor, I believe.
The Raptor. So then Secretary of Defense Panetta, he gets off an airplane to meet with the Chinese president, and they park this fighter jet that they have developed right next to where he flies in it, and it's really an in-your-face. It's basically, hey, Panetta, you see that? We stole it from you. That's now our fighter jet. So is this the attitude of the Chinese?
Well, there's two things going on. First, I'll say that there's a dynamic among all nations that are competing militarily where they go after each other's military IP. And that is less of a worry, while it's still a huge problem, while those plans cost billions and billions, hundreds of billions of dollars. That's less of a worry because many people are going to try to do that, and that should be expected. And it's partly on us, not that they, you know, shouldn't have done it. I mean, they shouldn't have done it, but we would probably do the same thing. It's partly on us to defend our own IP, particularly in the Defense Department. So that's preposterous that we let that slip. But also, we're entering an era where the focus on military espionage is starting to ebb a little bit, not as though it's losing value or losing importance, but we're also bringing in an understanding of the importance of civilian intellectual property. So at InventIP, that's our biggest worry, is that the civilian sector has been ignored for a very long time. And we're only now just beginning to bring this country to a place where we understand that we all, in our daily jobs, are probably working with very valuable intellectual property, and that we should be protecting that. And that if the Defense Department is losing things like the new plans for a stealth jet, then we're way behind. And our civilian corporations are probably even much farther behind than the Defense Department. So it's not a good sign.
So on the civilian side, when we develop something and we find out that the Chinese have hacked into it and stolen it, we're not going to put sanctions against the Chinese, are we?
Well, that's a complicated issue. That gets, you know, very deep into the diplomacy and politics that we have to use to deal with another major world power.
I mean, I think we should, but I don't think we have the capability to do that.
So what we're looking at right now is a shift from complete inability to do that towards what really does look like, particularly in that executive order, real sanctions. So the WTO was supposed to be traditionally a forum for sanctions to be placed against, you know, any country that violated its principles. And the Chinese were allowed to accede to the WTO, to join the WTO, without actually signing regulations of the WTO and making a commitment, with the, you know, slight caveat that they would sign in 10 years when they were capable of meeting those restrictions, which is a bit of a silly way to bring someone into an organization if they're clearly unprepared and self-declaredly unprepared. So that never happened, and even after those 10 years, they never followed these regulations, and they continued to steal intellectual property and violate multiple rules in the WTO. But that's such a slow-moving organization. I think there are benefits to the WTO, but we've had a lot of trouble getting anything out of sanctions that should have been in place within that framework. And so now I think we're moving to a place where we're searching elsewhere and kind of working around that issue. And I think that we may have made a mistake by letting them accede to the WTO. We kind of tied our own hands and, you know, the hands of the entire world in terms of bringing sanctions against them in that forum.
Evan, you talk about glimmers of hope, and you talk about ammunition that we are gaining, learning, developing here. What does this look like, say, for, you know, someone who is in a university computer science program? Are courses developed in this counter intellectual property theft, some of this ammunition? Where can we find it? What does it look like?
Right. Well, I mean, in the modern cyber world, we've got essentially a massive undercommitment of resources in our country, and a lot of people know that, and a lot of people are working on it. So there are a number of universities that are starting to build programs to deal with this, and we're very far behind, but we're clearly trying to catch up now, which yet again is a glimmer of hope. So we let this slide, and now we've realized it, and major universities are building cybersecurity programs, and some of them are being funded by the government to, you know, try to bring ourselves back up to snuff in this world, which really, in the next 100 years, this is going to be it, right? Mm-hmm. It's not as though conventional military forces will go away. That's not really how military buildups work, but this is a new aspect that we have to pay a lot of attention to, and it's going to become one of the most important aspects of our Defense Department and our broader security apparatus.
Meanwhile, we're educating the Chinese in our universities on cybersecurity.
We are speaking with Evan Anderson, Director of Marketing, Strategic News Service. Thanks so much for joining us this morning on Cool Science Radio.
Thank you. It's been a pleasure.
Okay.
Thanks,
we
Evan.
Are live from the Stein Erickson Lodge, the Future in Review Conference. We'll be back right after these messages.
Hi, I'm Dr. Bob Miller with Miller Orthodontics, a new sponsor on KPCW. Miller Orthodontics offer orthodontic care for patients of all ages. We provide a custom evaluation and offer flexible payment plans. Located in Kimball Junction across from Basin Rec, our website is m2ortho.com, 731-4111.
This is Chris Robinson with Berkshire Hathaway Home Services, Utah Properties. KPCW is one of the many nonprofits our agents and companies support. They are the backbone of Summit and Wasatch counties in our incredible community. More info at bhhsutah.com.
Additional funding for programming on KPCW is provided in part by Hideout Canyon, master planned community on the lake. Info at hideoutcanyon.com. Long Reimer Weiniger Bethler, Estate Planning, Family Law, lrw-law.com. And the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, and listeners like you.
And I want to thank our sponsors very quickly. Berkshire Hathaway Home Services, Utah Properties, Peak Art and Frame, Nexus IT, and our new sponsor, the Natural History Museum of Utah.
Also want to thank our guest today here at the Future in Review Conference, Cool Science Radio, coming to you live from the Stein Erickson Lodge. And what a great conference this is. John, this has been great speaking with these people here, having all of these high-level experts in one place for the 13th annual Future in Review.
Yeah, and everybody's walking around here so jazzed. You know, everyone's just, you know, grabbing energy from each other and learning about the different disciplines, and it's helping them as they collaborate on their individual projects.
That's right. Three great guests. We want to thank Khan Slobodjikov. He, again, is the Dr. Doolittle, Learning the Language of Animals. Also, Brett Horvath, co-founder of Scout, and Evan Anderson of the Strategic News Service. You're listening to KPCW Park City. We also want to thank our sound engineer over here, Roger Crawford, for setting us up. We've got Joel over there as well, and Monica here to, she's been taking video.
And Chandler, who is back on the board making everything possible. So we want to thank them, of course. I want to mention tomorrow on Morning Mix, Abrell's our musical guest, Libreta. And Libations, Utah Opera inspires craft cocktails in Park City, and PC Fun Seekers. Lynn, this is an over 40 group. It's a meetup group. There were, you know, 50 or 60 people this time last year. Now there's 300 people. It's pretty cool.
Sounds great. Time for news.